This is Dee Bethel, the writer and artist and creator of Long John at longjohncomic.com. I had a chance to sit down with longtime friend and now fellow comicker, Jason Tudor. Jason is the co-host, along with Keith Hewen and Michael Wistock, of the podcast The Science Fiction Show. And together with Keith Hewen, has started his science fiction espionage space opera webcomic, Vorpal. And I decided to sit down with him and have a nice conversation about not only his webcomic, but also the motivation, the trials, the tribulations, and all the work, sweat, frustrations, and psychological energy that goes into making a webcomic, especially when it's your first one. Just an extra note, this is the extended cut of what ended up on my weekly Nerd Geeky discussion show for all intents and purposes. So if you heard that, don't be fooled that this is just a repost. This is actually much, much longer than the truncated version you heard on that show, if you heard it at all. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Jason Tudor. But let's get to the brass tacks here. Tell us about Vorpal, and if you want to, just give us the elevator pitch and see, kind of, let us know what it's about just before we get started.
Sure, elevator pitch. And you know, it's funny, I hadn't really thought of an elevator pitch.
It could be a long elevator ride if you need
it. Eon Flux meets the Fifth Element. Maybe that's one way to say it.
Wow.
Girl assassin gets in trouble and has to figure herself out, and along the way she discovers many different things about herself and about the society and about this world that she lives in, which we hope culminates in a big finish. Going in, we had a pretty clear concept of what I wanted. I mean, I had an idea of the world she inhabited. I had an idea of her because I saw this powerful female character, despite her diminutive stance and despite her sort of appearance. I saw this sort of strong character, and I saw this idea of this very lethal assassin, but in a very sort of human way. And the way the story arc should take place is something along the lines of, as I said. So I think when you get into the whole girl assassin thing, you talk about Eon Flux, which is,
right.
I think that's more 80s, 90s. A lot of people won't remember that. But then you talk about Fifth Element, which is a film that still sort of resonates with folks. And yeah. So that's got a little bit of both of that. The idea that she's something more than what she is. And actually in the next couple of pages, let's see, I got to do one, two. So in three more pages, that will start to unfold. Mm-hmm. So I had the idea, I was working with on another project with a friend of mine in Australia, Daniel Picciotto, who's going to be a brilliant, wonderful comic book artist. His stuff is just amazing. Mm-hmm. I was dragging my feet, and I had a lot of personal issues going on subsequent to arriving in New York, where my wife and I now live. And at some point, I had to get out of the project for the good of Dan. I mean, I was holding mm-hmm. him back. I really was. And I just got caught up with too many other things. But he's been, so I had to let that go, and he's been very gracious about that. But Dan was also the guy who did the first vision of Vorpal, and I kind of gave him some parameters and things like that. After I finished that, I was doing some sort of self-exploration. I'm a guy who's been through cancer. I'm getting older, in my 40s. And I sort of said, I had this dream as a kid that I wanted to do a comic book. But, you know, hope is not a plan. So I will turn 40, mid-40s this year. And I said, look, if I'm not going to do this now, I'm not going to do it. And so Vorpal is kind of an amalgamation of a lot of things. My good friend Michael Wistock in California, living out in Petaluma, he knows that I've always had this penchant for sort of mercenary characters. I had a character in high school called Corsair Stevens, this long-haired mercenary who protected San Diego. I know I was 15. I was a big fan of Mike Grell's John Sable Freelance and Timothy Truman's Grimjack and all those sort of, and I'm a big fan of like Inspector Morse and Columbo and these sort of anti-heroes. I don't know that they're anti-heroes, but these sort of curmudgeonly, independent, smarter than you guys. So I have this penchant for characters who are independent, fiercely so, and maybe not liked by a lot of people. And that has evolved into Vorpal. So that's kind of where we're at. I asked Keith to join me on the project because I prefer to collaborate rather than to work independently. I like to have somebody to bounce ideas off of. And he wanted to do some writing, offer some ideas that he had from other stories. So that's what he's doing right now. He's actually penned a bit of these pages that I'm making right now. So his involvement in the project is kind of in that mode. That's a long answer. Sorry about that.
No. And you covered a lot of different topics that I wanted to talk about, actually.
Well, then I'll embellish from here. How's that?
Right. But you mentioned that it's an idea that you've had for a while, at least in some shape or form.
Mm-hmm.
How, I guess the question I have is, and you touched on it a little bit, like, when was Vorpal as a character kind of, when did she show up in your head? And how, more specifically, between then and now, how much has she, and perhaps the story, changed?
Yeah, great question. She showed up in my head, honestly, probably, 2011.
Okay.
And I remember, for lack of a better word, I woke up one day and I said, and I saw short hair, short white hair, tiny but giant assassin's rifle, right? A giant sniper rifle. Like, and the whole idea was that she belongs to this order of assassins and they make their own rifles. And this, and you'll find out this later in the comic. I'm not really spoiling anything. In fact, it's coming up pretty quickly. So, and it's already been mentioned, the Holy Order of the Long Rifle.
Right.
Is this sort of group, a cadre of assassins and killers who are employed, sort of an Illuminati type. You and I have kind of batted this back and forth a little bit. So she is basically on point as Samuel L. Jackson put it so evil, the tyranny of evil men, right? And so she is one of the henchmen, like Jules Winfield. And so she has to go out and sort of put people in their place when they get out of line with the powers that be. And there's this sort of shifting. And that's always sort of been, that's always been the character pitch, right? It's not much of a story necessarily, but that's sort of been the niche. Part of when I was working on this project with Dan was, again, I wanted to do the project with Dan, but I wanted to do this. And in between, I had some real personal things going on, some medical issues, some other things. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't doing either. And I really got in this place where, as many artists do, you're just bogged down and anxious and, you know, you're in, what's it called, paralysis by analysis, right?
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I got there. I was there full force. But once I was able to kind of tell Dan, look, I got it, you know, you need to do your thing. I regret making you wait this long. He was cool with it. I waited about 4 or 5 months, and then I said, I've got to do this. So that's kind of where it came from.
Right. Well, it actually gets to another question I wanted to brush upon, was that in my day job as a writing instructor, one of the guiding idea men is a guy named Donald Murray. And again, we're talking about writing essays and stuff, but I like it because I think it's true. Creating anything follows basically the same kind of process. Mm-hmm. You know, how do I get what's in my head onto the page?
Right.
And one of the things he talks about, all my students love that he talks about procrastination and how it's kind of good. But what he actually talks about is that what it's part of and what we all get to is this idea of we think about things, we process things until we get a signal to that we tell ourselves that it's okay to start making. And you kind of touched upon it with that last answer. Like, what was, if you can boil it down to even one signal, what was kind of the signal that got you to go like, okay, I need to make Vorpal the comic?
I think it was what I mentioned before. It was that notion of, it's not hubris of me to want to, as you know, I write it for, you know, Keith helps write it.
Right.
But I draw it, I ink it, I color it as well. I come up with the design. So it's sort of a self-inflicting project.
I understand.
That's not by choice, believe me. It's sort of out of necessity. It's that I can't really afford somebody to color it for me right now. But it was sort of that, Dan. It really was just a, look, at 17, I bitched and moaned and said, this is what I wanted to do at 17. And here I am at 40-something, and I haven't done this yet. I spent a whole career in the military, 22 years, and I probably could have done it in spades. I probably could have gone out and got my education at somewhere like the Kubert School or SCAD or something weird like that to do sequential art. I didn't do any of that. So doom on me for not doing that. But the kick in the pants was just sort of that realization of, I've got to do this now.
Right. Well, at least you're facing this sort of threshold, so to speak. And that's exactly where I was at when I decided to stop doing Evan 07 and pursue Long John. Like, my life had just changed dramatically, mostly in positive ways.
Yeah.
And like, it felt like a beginning. It felt I needed to do something new and something that spoke to who I was at this moment. Well, and it sounds like that's kind of, you know, for all the perhaps morbid aspects that you're talking about, it's still a similar kind of aspect that you confronted. You're like, I want to say something, because if you had made this at 17, it wouldn't be what it is.
Oh, it'd be shit. Yeah, no, it'd be awful.
But this is you as a mature writer, and I don't mean that in terms of age. I mean just like you've been writing for your entire career.
And it may still be shit because I mean I haven't written for comics, right? I mean I've done screenplays for folks. I've done a couple of those. I've done some short story fiction. I've done, you know, as a journalist, I've done thousands of stories about people. So I've done feature writing, and I have been able to use language in a way I hope that conveys, you know, something about the human being that's part of that, and to be able to tell a story. But it that doesn't mean it won't be shit. It just means simply that I'm at a point now where I think I can tell a story, and I know I'll still be weak on that because I haven't, you know, I remember on one of your posts on Long John, you're talking about the character journey, I think it was.
Right, the heroic circle.
Yeah, the heroic circle. And I know almost nothing about that other than what I've read. So what I don't know is execution. So I don't know if I can execute this. Now, as I mentioned this on, I was on a very friendly people let me on their podcast about a week ago, the Sci-Fi Geeks Club. And I was talking about, I've got 23 chapters outlined, and I could see this thing from sort of beginning to the end. It's the in-between stuff that usually throws me, you know? So I'll have to figure that out.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, that's the thing, especially for if you're drawing something. Like, we all can think of the payoff, but drawing takes so damn long. It's like, why can't we just jump there?
So I'm on page, we're currently working on, actually I'm redoing page, I think it's 11 right now, and it's this scene where...
It breaks my heart.
We're Vorpal.
Redrawing a page is like my nightmare.
I did this page, and I looked at the last couple panels, and I said, this sucks, because I had to go through my sort of sequential art and say, well, this fight sequence doesn't end where it should. It ends very abruptly, and then all of a sudden it's at this point. So I had to go back and kill three panels, add some dialogue, and sort of make it where it was. So, I mean, this page has been giving me the fits, and I just finished, actually I got up a little early and I finished it this morning, and then I started, what I figured out is I'm going to have to make a new page to go in between, because I had this one page I've seen for a long time of Vorpal falling out of something. I think you'll see this in a couple of pages. I've imagined this page for a very long time. It's very Frank Miller-esque. You'll see that when you see the page. But this page that I just sort of clutched through this morning, it really baked my head. But once I sort of, and I think I previewed that panel that I had to, one of the panels I had to redo in my feed of her sort of lying exhausted with the knife out in front of her, after this sort of battle she has, that's when it came together. It's like, okay, boom. But then I realized I have to transition her from this fight to this, okay, now she has to make a choice, a literal sort of down the rabbit hole, which is, she's already sort of done that. So that sort of goes in line with her name. And we're sort of treading on the Alice in Wonderland thing, as many have.
Yeah.
So she's already sort of started down the rabbit hole, but she has to go down farther, in both a distant sense and further in sort of a mental sense. And so she's about to do this, and how I have that part pretty well done. It was this sort of in-between sequence where I went, I have no idea what to do here. So I had to take a couple days and really think it through, and it's put me behind schedule. But on the other hand, the page is a lot better than I hoped it would be.
That's something that you've been talking about, and this is so totally normal from my experience, sort of at the beginning of, I was doing this when at the end of my run of Evan 07, where we were adding pages and changing art around. But especially at the beginning of this, and I talked about this a bit on Long John, where I actually scrapped an entire page. It was actually supposed to be the first page.
Right. I remember that, yes.
I think on the most recent page that you have up, the Killshot page, you talked a little bit about having to change art or really struggling with what you wanted to show.
So the struggle with that was, you know, I talked a little in the blog post that accompanied it, I talked about the gore aspect. That was the easy part. Again, that was another page, and you actually helped me on that, and I thank you a million times for that. It didn't still quite come out the way I wanted it, but it sort of did. And that last panel is kind of comical in a lot of ways. It's gory, but in it, you know, I wanted to show a couple things. One was that what she does, as I said in the blog post, what she does, she's a killer. I mean, she's not a good guy. Right. She is a dyed-in-the-wool killer. Anti-hero, however you want to say it. But the second thing was you had to show the consequences of this, as I mentioned.
Right.
Now, that page actually got changed about 2 days before I posted it. And the change was, if you look at the bottom panel, there are two figures alongside of him who are sort of oblivious to this bullet punching through his head. I added those kind of at the last minute because I realized this page was very stark. And it didn't have a lot. It didn't really have a movement or anything to it. And it's still not great, but that's kind of where it went.
It actually gets to kind of what I wanted to talk about with regard to what's going on right now on the comic. I'm guessing you're kind of finishing up this opening scene.
So we're getting close. Right. It's sort of, again, it's what we'll see her transition to is, okay, she's pulled off this job. She's been really sly about stalking her target, and it's gone so well, and the robot loves her and helps her out. And now we're going to see a bit of a, okay, we've got our hero up the tree. Let's throw rocks at the hero a little bit now.
Right.
And let's see what she can do. So this, if it all works out, the opening sequence should be 14 pages, including the first flashback, which is absolutely crucial. And I'm actually, one of the things I'm trying to do is explore a different style of art for that particular page, so that kind of like you do at times where you sort of use it as a different medium to kind of set the stage. Right. And so that's where I'm looking forward to getting to that page. But I got to get past these next few pages to do that. So, yeah, absolutely.
Right. You're referring to in Ebono 7 for just to give you the nuts and bolts here. I drew the comic for the majority of it with a dip pen to mimic sort of the thick to thin line work of Photoshop, to be perfectly honest. But one story we did set in the 60s when our character went to try to kill Castro. And I drew that all with Micron technical pens.
Right.
And did it in black and white. But within that story, we did a flashback even further to, what is this, Inception?
we have to go deeper. We've got to go deeper.
We flash back to the Lincoln assassination, during which I drew it only in pencil.
Right.
And that's, to me, I don't know if that was a smart move, but it was like, I'm like, how do I show this and make it look different?
Well, I love that. And I love when artists can sort of shift mediums to get a different feel. You know, you talk about filmmakers who may do something with the film, like Spielberg did with Schindler's List, and what Coppola did with The Godfather. I think he did some sort of sepia, you know, did something with the film. And that's pretty common there. What you did with Ebono 7, but also, you know, I like how you and Andrew, the art styles contrast, you know, and I think I mentioned this to you before, I'm a big fan of the comic Cerebus, the independent comic, which went 300, and a lot of people don't like Dave Sim because he's such a misogynist, and we can go on and on.
Right.
But I did love his artwork, and I did think some of his story was very clever, specifically the church and state stuff. But the way he and Gerhard, and I know you and I have talked about that, but Gerhard did his backgrounds later on, and Then they sort of mix things up a little bit in there as well. So I think when you are applying it to a different mood, or you're trying to throw back or something like that, you know, an easy way to throw back on a memory is just to make it black and white, I suppose.
Right.
But I've already, these memories that she's having, these flashbacks, I already know the medium I want to do it. I just don't know if I can execute it because I don't work in the medium at all.
Right.
But this is going to be a challenge for me. So if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. We'll see.
Actually, let's talk about creating the comic, because you do a really interesting thing that's really interesting to me, because I wouldn't even know how to go about doing this, because you use a bit of blending. Well, you draw the thing.
Yep.
Right? But aren't you using some 3D software to help build it?
I do.
A little bit?
I do. So I generally thumbnail everything out, try to sketch everything out. But I want to make this look as good as possible. And my art skills aren't nearly on the caliber that they should be for a man who's drawn since he was 15 years old. And that's to my own testament. So the wonderful thing is that there's a great reference tool called Poser, made by Smith Micro. And there's some great folks who support that. So I generally tend to build a scene using some of that, and then sketch that. I try to build that as part of the scene in Manga Studio 4EX. No, I haven't upgraded yet. I'm going too soon. And then from there, once the sketch is done, then we start the inking process. I love the inking process. To me, that's like, I'm almost done. Yay. And then I realize I've got to color it. So after I make the inks in Manga Studio, I save those out as a TIFF file, 1200 DPI TIFF file. I bring those into my 5-year-old copy of Photoshop, and then I color. I do the flatting, which I just learned how to do as I started the comic, with some fantastic tutorials from folks on the web. And again, part of the challenge for me there is I haven't done it that way before, and I'm colorblind. So I have to be especially cautious with flesh tones, with anything that's red, with anything that's red or green. Now, if it's starkly red or green, that's easy. But when the more subtle hues, which I try to stay away from, I get a little confused. Purples, blues, that kind of thing. So then I color it. That usually takes the longest, usually between 10 and 12 hours to color, just man hours. Once it's colored, from that point on, it's just kind of a quality check. Save it out as a PNG file. I save three versions, and then I post the 72 DPI version on the website. The goal with this first chapter will be, like you did with Long John, to make a primer and to have that available as sort of a, here we are, please buy our comic.
Actually, I'm glad you brought up the coloring, because I feel like I'm hopscotching all over the place. But there's a logic to it.
Yeah.
Overall, tonally, it's pretty serious, pretty dark, because it's about an assassin. Mm-hmm. But you do have moments of levity mm-hmm. and comedy and stars. Mm-hmm. But for a sci-fi comic, I really like how it's kind of bucking a lot of the trends, which tend to be more towards muddy or like earth tones.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it's either that or it's Apple, right? Where it's all very white and clean.
Oh, yeah.
You have very technicolor, bright, vivid world that you've created. What were kind of some of the, and you mentioned the Fifth Element, which I'm like, oh, of course, it makes sense now.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? What were some other sci-fi inspiration? Because this is a science fiction comic.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a space opera. I mean, and I guess it's sci-fi too, but, you know, first, on the coloring, I think that's also a product of colorblindness. You know, a very good friend of mine is an artist in Michigan. Her name's Valerie McGovern, a brilliant painter, and she tends to paint with these very bright palettes, and she's also colorblind. And so I think some of the brightness comes from just, you know, maybe overcompensating for me wanting to be pleased by what I see on the page. Right. So I think it's part of that. I think it's also what you mentioned is color sets a mood, right? And
right.
So if to me that she's outside doing a hit on some fat guy, I mean, it's high noon. So the sun's going to be out and all the colors are going to be in display. It's not a nighttime hit. All these things have to happen. So I didn't see it that way. I guess I don't see the world so dystopian as many people do. I mean, it's
right.
Obviously with our corporate and industrial sort of malaise, it certainly could go that way. But, you know, I liked the Fifth Element sort of Jean-Paul right. Gaultier view of that in a lot of ways, but not right. quite that, that far over. Right. As far as influences, I mean, we could talk about that all day, right? I mean, right, you know, right. I mentioned a few of the comics. I think of Blade Runner and Star Wars and Fifth Element and so many other science fiction films in between. Outland is another one that I always talk about, and so many other things. So it's this amalgamation of things, I suppose. But the element that I haven't really talked about much, and this may surprise you, is I also have a big James Bond fetish. So there is a sort of secret agent-ish element to this, I think.
Sure.
That's why I was drawn to Ebon 07 as well, because I was like, this is James Bond. I got to read this, right? And right. So there's definitely a James Bond sort of secret agent, you know, guy girl who knows how to do all the things and be cool and, you know,
right.
jump out of off a cliff with a British parachute and then cue the theme music sort of thing. So the right. all that influence was kind of there for that.
It's interesting because I think when a lot of people think of like committing an assassination, I think it is smart to go like, well, let's go high noon, because I think a lot of people would think of midnight. Mm-hmm. They would. This is murder. This is a dark deed.
Right.
That should be taking place in the cover of night, because that's when bad things happen.
Right.
However, what's interesting is that you by putting it in the middle of the day, you do kind of create a sense of normalcy. Like, this is just her job.
Exactly right.
In a sense. But bad stuff does still happen at night. And that really comes through on the fourth page, describing the sneak, I think it's called.
Right.
Where you actually have her at night and use really high contrast, sort of almost like Sin City, Frank Miller kind of inking, coloring technique. And like, oh, this is how dark it gets. This is what happens at night, right? Where it gets really dangerous. Because it is still a dangerous time, but danger is just being redefined in this comic, which is cool.
Well, and I think there are certain tropes you have to follow, right? I think, you know, sure. evil things happen at night, and when it starts raining, things start to get worse. And when the sun comes up, you know, new beginnings. And when the sun goes down, that's the end of your film. All those. I think you still have to have those visual cues, because I think a great sure. deal of your audience understands. I think, like, the sneak page, I wanted to show that she could get close to this guy. And in that last mm-hmm. panel, she's slept with the guy, for lack of a better word. Right. So she's inches from the guy, but she can't kill him because the order mm-hmm. has said he needs to die in a loud, public, messy manner using primitive right. means. And so a lot of people see it. There was that notion of she could have did it, and it could have been just, you know, cutting his throat in bed. But right. But I liked the idea of, yeah, she needs to do this in broad daylight, and she needs to get away with it in broad daylight, because obviously right. night and rain and smog and fog all offer the opportunity for cover, but mm-hmm. broad daylight, there's got to be something to that. So, and
sure.
as you'll see in the coming pages, it doesn't necessarily work out the way she thought it would, and she can't figure out why, and that's right. sort of an element of what happens. But again, there's this element of, yeah, as you said, flipping the script on the trope and saying, okay, how could she do this in broad daylight? And that's, right. you know, she knows he's got at 8:30 every day, he steps out of his office and gets into a limousine or some shuttle, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. And that's when she has to kill him, because that's will be the best time for her to, you know, put the bullet on target, that kind of thing.
Right. And like I was saying, when we think of what is danger? And at night, we think of murder,
right? But
again, that's her normal day. So what to her? And you're defining this really well for the audience, is like what's danger for her? And that's perhaps not being forced, but realizing that she's using herself,
right?
You know, and it's the body horror kind of thing. I mean, in a couple of ways, because of the dude she slept with, and of course using sex as a tool,
right?
Which is interesting. Yeah,
and one of my favorite films is The Professional with Jean Reno and Natalie Portman. Right. Mm-hmm. Now here's a guy who's absolutely not afraid to do his job. He's just number right. one, A+, just doesn't think twice about it. He's a killer. But what is he afraid of is losing the girl, right? And we all know that's an odd relationship, so we won't get too deep into that. But she, right. he cares about the girl to the degree at which you believe he cares about her is for discussion. Point being, here is my girl, the assassin, and I think it's a similar template. She's absolutely comfortable, you know, in combat, doing the fighting, she's got all the moves. But when she starts to make these discoveries about herself and her, what these memories ensue and what she is, that scares her. And I think that's right. that's an interesting sort of pin to spin it on.
The last thing I kind of wanted to talk about, even though there's other stuff we could talk about, but we've touched on a lot of it already. One character we haven't really talked about that I think is really, really interesting is Argo.
Mm-hmm.
Argo is a robot.
Mm-hmm.
That's a flying eyeball.
Pretty much.
Seems to be snarky. A very snarky, kind of sarcastic character. But what's also interesting about it is that you shared some design sketches of the character.
Mm-hmm.
And you really went into detail developing what all these pieces on this machine do.
Right.
I wanted you to talk about Argo a little bit, but I think that also speaks to world building. And how detailed are you going? How much do you know about the world? How much do you need to know about the world to make another place?
Right.
Or is there some still vagary? I don't know if that's a word, but I'm going
to
use it.
That's a great question, by the way. Mm-hmm. So Argo is, I don't think, anything new to you and I or to a lot of science fiction fans. You know, my friend Michael said, hey, thanks for the Oblivion reference on Argo kind of being this round golf ball. And I said, yeah, there was a little of that. There was a little of C-3PO. I mean, it's a lot of things, sure. but essentially Argo is her, for lack of a better word, manservant. I call it a robotic familiar, I think is what I called it in the comic.
Nice.
And so this thing is built for her. It serves her. You know, it's really what I saw in Argo was every sniper in the military has an observer. Both the sniper and the observer are part of a team. That's very, you know, the snipers do go out on their own, but it's not as frequent. They usually have an observer who sits behind them with a thing, and they look through scopes more than they shoot, right. and they talk to each other about, you know, make the shot, not make the shot, wind, you know, what do you see? I thought there would be this interesting relationship. Now, she's not always a sniper. This just happens to be part of her skill set. But I did see the relationship with sort of having an observer, a partner, something like that, but also a little comic relief, right? Because if it's all assassination and murder and sad backstory and that sort of thing, then we turn away and go find something else. Argo knows she's incredibly skilled at what she does, you know, so right. you see him poking fun at her at times. And in this page that I just finished building, you'll see that again. So I think that's an essence to the story. And Argo actually will play a huge role in coming chapters. So part of the world building has been that I've always known that she lives in this system of nine, or this sort of universe of nine systems, and with the solar system being one of those, we'll call it system three. So there are eight other systems that have sort of been we've figured out, and there is trade and commerce, and so that I think is a little influenced by Dune in terms of you know, industrial and commerce and things like that and how these worlds built. We sort of made Earth the center of gravity again simply because people will be familiar with Earth, some of the cities, some of the other ways. So you have these mega cities, for lack of a better word, that have blown up. So there's a little Judge Dredd influence there, I think, too.
Nice.
Well, she will be staging out of New Orleans, which is now called New Orleans Prime, which spreads into East Texas, up into Arkansas, and over into the panhandle of Florida. It's a huge mega city. And that's where all the sort of commerce and trade and all the dirty stuff that you can't do, you know, that you have to do in, you know, in a New York port or, you know, in a Los Angeles harbor, where all the sort of dirty trade goes on, where you dump your waste, that happens in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. So she'll stage out of there, but there'll be lots of others. In terms of actually building the world, we have a lot of it. We have a lot of ideas on what things are. And we've actually, one of the things we did before we started launching Pages was we built a wiki. And so the wiki is only visible to us at this point. What we do is we started throwing things, and I started putting things that I could remember. For instance, like her, you're going to be seeing her personal spacecraft soon, which I'm still sort of sorting out. I hate to admit that, but I'm sorting that out still. So there are a number of things that we have a pretty hard tack on. One of the things we're trying to do is map out the nine systems. Now, we know the solar system is one of those systems, but we don't have quite as good a picture on what the other nine are. So those may come organically as we build the story a bit more, but we'd really like to get more in place because we know this will give more material for folks to dive into and read on and sort of sink their teeth into. So that was important to us to have a world that is tangible and things that happen. And, you know, I don't know that it's the suspension of disbelief so much as when you get into this world, you can identify, oh, okay, this is sort of post-industrial. This is, you know, and again, I'm not shooting for apocalyptic. Again, I'm probably shooting more of a Fifth Element world, more of a something in between dystopian and Fifth Element, sort of riding the line more toward Fifth Element because I like things that are brighter. So, and yes, I think the key there is, yes, it was important for us to try to define the world as clearly as possible as we get started. This place that she's carrying out this particular hit on, Erescadorn, that was the first venue I had. It was I had been noodling with this place in a three-dimensional program called Bryce, and there were already sort of other things like that. But like I saw a model for a cloud city once, but I didn't like that. What I saw were these sort of cities on floating rocks in a cloud. Yeah. So a little like Cloud City, I guess, Bespin, but also it had more of an industrial feel, but it was secluded and private and secure and all these other things. Right. I know I showed you that first panel many times and I asked your opinion on ways to go on that. And I definitely appreciate that as well as all the other advice I got from folks. But eventually that's where it ended up. I'm a fan of the first page because that's the page I've seen since 2011, right?
Nice.
That's what I've seen since 2011 with some slight variations. And many of these other images are ones I've seen. So the world building is important and it sort of starts with this floating city. And, you know, I think our next scene will be in New Orleans in her apartment. And then we're going to continue to build from there. And I think at some point we're going to figure out what pirates are. And we're going to figure out what scientists are. And we're going to figure out what the chancellor of the system looks like and what he does or what it does, because we're still exploring sort of how alien we want to make things and on and on and on. So yes, the world building aspect is very important. And you know, the thing I'm impressed by, you know, I'm trying to do it as well as you do it with Long John in terms of that California depiction, you know, and that feeling of, you know, that was California, because I remember going to Calico, the ghost town down near, going out toward Barstow. My parents used to take me there all the time. And I remember when I started reading Long John, like, this feels a lot like that, you know, not as touristy, but I mean, the scenics were very much the same. So I want to take that plausibility in the same vein that you have, in the same vein that, say, Mobius has, who is, I think, brilliant at building worlds as well, try to do at least a sliver of that with this. And if I can get at least a sliver of that, if somebody goes, yeah, that's tasty, then if one person does it, that's good. And we appreciate that. And, you know, we just want to continue to build on that. And obviously, Dan, the most important thing is the story, telling the story and that intersection of words and pictures and design and color and all of those things, and trying not to lean too heavily on one thing and trying to make that balance right, so that when you look at a page, you go, cool, you know, and that nothing gets in the way, that nothing, you go, oh, that's weird. Or you just read it and you go, okay, I'm ready for the next page. That to me is probably one of the biggest compliments you can get.
Well, Jason, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show again. And there's still a lot of things we could talk about. I could talk shop all day.
I know.
And we'd love to have you back on at some point and see where Vorpal's gone. And we'll keep talking about what it's like to make comics and the mystery that it is.
I love talking all about this stuff, Dan. And I have to compliment you. I think I've said this on your show before. You're just such a big influence and such a good friend in terms of just being able to say, is this stupid? Am I going to do okay with this? Is this not the right way to go? And I appreciate that. And the work that you've done over the years with Ebon 07 and with this wonderful Long John thing, man, it's just, it's awesome. I hope you keep doing it. I hope it rolls as long as you're able to keep it rolling. And I can't thank you enough for that, man.
That's very nice to hear. And so you hear me deflecting compliments already. So where can people find you and all your stuff?
More importantly, the comic is at vorpal.atomicbazookastudios, which is kind of the little partnership Keith and I have right now, which also includes the science fiction show now. Vorpal at atomicbazookastudios, all one word, .com. You can find me at jasontutor.com, which will actually is referring to an about.me page right now because of some issues that I'm having with my website. But I will hope you'll take a look at it. We think it's different. We think it's a little different than maybe from some other things that you'll see, the art and where the story's going and how we're approaching it as well. Because, and I don't mean to drag this out, but I think the way we're approaching this is not necessarily in a comic book fashion. I can't think of any other way. It's just the way we're doing this is just the way we're doing it. And, you know, we'll take our lumps and learn our lessons, but we're just going to keep doing it and see what happens. So,
yeah, it's much more cinematic in approach, which is a style of comicking at this point, too. So, you know, because those are the mediums. Well, you're familiar with comics. You know, I think a lot of comics pull from the medium of cinema. And there's been a lot actually written about, is that a good thing or not? But who cares? it's about telling a story. Well, it's been an absolute blast talking to you, Jason.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate you letting me struggle through with my cold here. And thanks to everybody for listening in.
Once again, you can read Jason and Keith's webcomic, Vorpal, at vorpal.atomicbazookastudios.com. I would also recommend listening to their podcast, The Science Fiction Show, that Jason does with Keith and Michael Wistock. You can find Vorpal on Facebook, and I suggest you bookmark it. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you got as much out of it as I did. It's always fun to talk to creative people, especially when they're very open about just figuring things out. I feel I do that, at least I try to, and I hope you got something out of it as well. Thank you for listening. I'm Dee Bethel. Recording from LongJohnComic.com.